WBAI.
My name's Chris Hedges. I'm the author with the cartoonist Joe Sacco of Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And when Joe and I are in New York, we always listen to WBAI 99.5 or WBAI.org because we want to stay informed and not get fed the commercial lies of the corporate media.
Come down and jam Wednesday, September 19th as the show hosted by yours truly. That's me, Ife, and the Mighty G-Man in conjunction with WBAI brings to you an evening of soul, funk, R&B, disco, and hip-hop. Music of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Join us Wednesday, September 19th at Le Poisson Rouge, 158 Bleecker Street in Manhattan, 6 to 10 p.m. for this free event. I'll be on the set mixing it up along with other guest DJs. The Mighty G-Man will MC. Come relax and have a great time at this, did I mention, free social occasion. For more information, please call 212-209-2941. That's 212-209-2941. Can't wait to see you there to set the fall off right. 99.5 WBAI.
On Wednesday, August 29th, starting at 6 p.m. at 120 Wall Street, the WBAI Community Advisory Board will be holding a meeting to discuss what is to be done to improve WBAI's programming and rebuild our audience. This meeting is a second in a series of dialogues to turn around WBAI from the dire possibilities of collapse. We are looking for ideas and solutions, not diatribe. Please bring your photo ID for access to the building. All are welcome.
This is Phil Donahue, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5.
And it is just about 7 o'clock p.m. You are listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, and it is time for another exciting episode of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
And a very good evening to you. The program is Off the Hook. Rob T. Firefly here with you. I am joined in the studio by Mike.
Good evening.
And on the telephone by Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
And not by Emmanuel Goldstein, who is apparently paddling his car uptown from downtown from parts unknown because we're having flash floods and things like that.
I've received a text message.
A text message?
A text message that says he will be here in 5 minutes, if you want to believe anything you ever see by text message.
I don't know if I trust text messages, but okay, according to the clock on the wall, it is 7:02 and 22 seconds. So if we add 5 minutes to that, I think we can, we'll test the veracity of this text format of which you speak.
Well, it also depends on when I received the text message, which was, you know.
Well, I received the text message just now.
All right.
When,
all right,
when you related
fair.
It to me verbally.
That's fair. But all kinds of things are going on elsewhere in the world. Did you see this story from Copenhagen?
Copenhagen.
Copenhagen, the capital of Denmark, has decided that they have all these CCTV cameras all over the place, which is not particularly unusual for large cities, but they've decided they have enough of them. They aren't doing anything to stop crime, and they're going to not put up any more. I don't know what this guy's title, ch.supt. Anyway, that's his title. His name is Sven Foldegar. And he says it's extremely costly to get both the data in and to archive it, so we have to weigh up the benefits. It does not have any preventative effect. We can use it to investigate some things, and that's good, but CCTV doesn't really make a difference.
This is sounding an awful lot like sanity and a reasonable assessment of events. What's this guy doing in power?
I don't know. And then there's also this guy, Peter Lauritsen, who is the head of the Forum for Surveillance Studies at Aarhus University, which sounds kind of creepy, but he agrees. He says that CCTV is often put in place to have a preventative effect, but research shows that CCTV has only a minimal effect on serious crime, and that much of the violence that takes place is not premeditated or that takes place under the influence, and here perpetrators don't think rationally about the consequences of video monitoring.
Wait, surveillance studies is a subject at a university.
He is the head of the Forum for Surveillance Studies.
So for those of you still looking for a major, I don't know.
I would assume that's like where the surveillance people study, but apparently he says, yeah, you don't need it so much.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for a bit of a reasonable voice in the surveillance studies field. What do you think, Bernie?
You could get a whole doctorate in that. There's so much surveillance going on. There's no shortage of knowledge to be had in that field. Here in Philadelphia, back in June, they discovered that they're spending like tens of millions of dollars on CCTV, and they discovered somebody discovered back in June that only about half the cameras are working, but they're still spending over $100,000 a year for each camera, even though they're not working. So people are asking questions about that. The city solicitor, which is the main lawyer for the city, is saying this is not good. So I guess he's overstating the obvious. But all this video surveillance, it's Orwellian, and it doesn't stop crime. It doesn't have any preventive effect. Who looks at the camera and says, "Oh, I better not have that fight that I was going to just punch this guy in the face or whatever"? It just doesn't work that way.
Well, this all ties in interestingly with another story that's been going around the past week about something called Trapwire, which apparently is a spy network that uses surveillance cameras all over the place, collates the data from them, and possibly uses facial recognition to identify who is where and doing what.
What country is this in?
This is in that country called the United States of America. And
So I thought the United States of America had like laws on reasonable expectations of privacy and whatnot.
Well, that's just crazy talk, because these people apparently have gotten a lot of money from our very government, who are supposedly in charge of those laws to do this. And they've got they've been leaked by WikiLeaks, who published a great deal of private emails that apparently spell out a great deal of information about this plan, and there are all sorts of reactions going on to it. And let's see here. Documents
where
from the U.S.
Where is it operating?
It's operating, let's see. It is operating in a couple of major cities so far.
Maybe they won't tell us.
Maybe they won't tell us.
From what I've read about it, you got to read between the lines in some of these stories, but it appears that it's taking information from a lot of sources through video, and that one of the sources of information is optical character recognition of license plates on vehicles. And you know, ostensibly this was originally just to make sure people weren't evading tolls, but as more and more of these automatic license plate reading cameras appear for people to travel in motor vehicles, we know that the law enforcement agencies aren't just discarding this data right away. They're logging this. They're archiving it for who knows how long. And once you start having a huge database of what vehicles are located where and when and how often and in proximity to what other motor vehicles' license plates, you can start data mining that for all kinds of information that many people would consider a violation of their privacy, like who they associate with, who they're traveling in caravans with, where they go, how often, and it's I think it's spooky.
It's very spooky. And of course, this was published by WikiLeaks, who have been having some issues of their own lately. Earlier this, I think it was yesterday, actually, that it was reported by The Guardian in the UK that Ecuador had approved Julian Assange's call for asylum. That was then denied by the Ecuadorian government earlier today, who said they're still reviewing.
They've promised to hold a news conference tomorrow at 7 a.m. Ecuador time, explaining what will happen next.
Yeah, so they're still reviewing the situation, and we thought we had news on it, and now we don't. So
I have a theory about this.
What's your theory?
I have a theory that this is one possible scenario, is that someone in Ecuador leaked this, that it really was going to happen, that was the plan, and then when the story came out, large governments such as the United States, which has a pending trade agreement up for renewal with the nation of Ecuador, and the UK, and a lot of other countries do a lot of trade with Ecuador. Ecuador probably heard this and decided to send some not so happy messages to them, saying, "Hey, you want to play ball with us? You better change your mind on this." So maybe that's what's going on. I don't know, but it seems possible.
So what you're saying is you're making this up.
I said I have a theory. Theories are things that are generally made up.
All right. Well, I guess tomorrow morning we'll find out what happens next.
Well, we won't. Yeah, we might know what happens next, but we might not know the backstory behind what's really happening. But you know, it seems like that's a plausible scenario. That it looks like. You know, I don't think Julian Assange would have done this. Apparently, he had contacts with the Ecuadorian government, high levels, before he jumped into the Ecuadorian embassy in the United Kingdom. Or in London to seek refuge, and so I don't think he would have done that if he thought there was no chance in hell of him getting political assignment. Maybe he was sort of given a sort of wink and a nod, like, yeah, okay, we'll do this, but now maybe it may or may not be working out that way.
Yeah, I'm coming in midway, and I apologize for this, but we're talking about Julian.
Yeah.
We're talking about Julian, I take it.
Yes.
What I've heard is that it seems likely he's going to get asylum. Is that not what you believe?
Well, it was the story came out a couple days ago that he was going to get it, and then someone from the Ecuadorian government said today that no, there's been no such decision made yet. And Mike's saying now that tomorrow there's going to be a press conference where there'll be more information available. And we were just speculating about what's really going on behind the scenes.
Well, that's the last thing I heard, too, was that there's going to be an announcement tomorrow. But it's interesting just seeing how the mainstream media is covering the story, because they seem to be saying that it looks like he's going to get asylum. I don't know what they're basing this on. But one thing, when I looked at the Al Jazeera story, if you read this story, which has a big picture of Assange and, I believe, the Ecuadorian president on the front of it, they say that the country or the president of the country there has been at odds with Washington in the past. Now, this whole story has nothing to do with Washington, supposedly, but it's interesting how that is being focused on more than anything else. And I have to wonder, you know, and maybe we could do an experiment where people who violate what's it called over there? Is it it's not probation, it's bail? What do they call it in England?
It was bail, I believe.
Is it bail? They use the same word? How interesting.
Yeah, they speak English there most of the time.
Huh, how about that? Well, okay, let's get a bunch of people who violate their bail to go to the embassy of their choice and see if those buildings get surrounded by police as well. I don't think they will. It's just very interesting how much attention the story is getting. So you have to wonder if maybe there's a little bit more to it in the mainstream than what we're being led to believe.
I mean, most people, if they go to an embassy, will just be, you know, summarily thrown out of the embassy. So
it happens to me. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Speaking of going interesting places, Mike, you're back from someplace interesting.
Yeah. You can see on my wrist.
Oh, Microsoft?
I wasn't going to say it on the air, but yeah.
Well, I'll say it on the air. Why do you have a Microsoft? That's
well, because
not where you went.
The other thing says where I went, which I guess we said last week, but we can reveal in 10 seconds. But apparently Microsoft gave them enough money to make it say Microsoft on my wrist right now.
My goodness, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, let's. I'm learning as I go along.
Yeah.
Mike, you were at Tour Camp, which is the second hacker camp in America.
The second Tour Camp. Yeah.
Well, as far as I know, are there hacker camps in America that we don't know about?
No, but you make it sound like someone else did it. But Tour Camp has done it twice.
Well, if you had let me finish the sentence, I would have said their first one was in 2009 in Western Washington, and this was in Eastern Washington.
Other way around.
Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah. Yes, thank you. This one was in Western Washington, which is a lot less dry and also on the ocean. And last week we talked to both you and Kyle out there. You were on your way to the event. You're back. Kyle is still over there, though, because he lives out in Seattle. Kyle, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, yeah, he's there. He's been on the phone actually the whole time since last week. We forgot to hang up.
Oh, well.
It's going to be wonderful.
If you had forgotten to hang up, then the call would have dropped at the camp. There was not a whole lot of mobile phone service there.
Give us, because we don't really have that very much time. And again, I do apologize for being late. Two things have to happen. Number one, it has to stop having these biblical weather conditions on Wednesdays. And two, our infrastructure must improve where things don't get totally flooded every time it rains, or almost every time it rains. But again, I will try and leave maybe 4 hours early next time, just so I can definitely be here on time. Tell us your quick impressions of what Tour Camp was like, and comparing it maybe to a European hacker camp.
It was smaller. It was about 500 people, which I think was actually a really nice size. I got to talk to a lot of the people. It was a lot harder to get to than anywhere in Europe, but...
couldn't just hop on the high-speed rail and...
No, you could not hop on the high-speed... You could... No. No. And there were a lot of interesting people there. There were a lot of interesting talks. One thing they did was that the first day of the camp, which was last Thursday, all the talks were 20 minutes long, so you got to see a lot of people talking about interesting things and then moving on to something else interesting.
Uh-huh.
There was people hacking, soldering. There was welding going on. There was a giant blue laser that I'm sure Kyle will tell us about. There was the Church of Robotron. Robotron is a game, a computer game, and they turned it into a church with candles and weird, ominous messages going out. And there was the ocean, too.
There's always the ocean. Now, Kyle, Mike mentioned the laser, and I know you were one of the key people in that particular project. What exactly are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, it's something that I helped with. I wasn't the key people. I definitely, in producing it, like for the event, I helped out a lot as far as like moving stuff around and setting stuff up. But
well, I believe you also were watching out for airplanes, and if that's not key, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I was a spotter for a little while. I basically just kept an eye out for things in the air and looked at the laser quite a bit. And it was a bit misty, but we had some good weather, almost a clear night once, or at least like some high clouds. And a group of people at HBL started this idea of using an array of 1-watt diodes to make a spectacle, and Tour Camp basically gave us an art grant so we could create this spectacle. And it turned out really, really well. There were a couple individuals involved that really like came through and coming up with cooling systems and a lot of software and stuff, different projects, like different sorts of safety interlocks and microcontrollers were used.
Well, just to describe the
system,
to describe the spectacle just a little bit. The pictures I saw, a brilliant blue beam of light pointed straight up into the heavens, and I think because it was cloudy, kind of exploding in the sky and basically bathing the entire area in blue light. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually a great way of describing it. That's exactly what it was.
There was a yurt.
Yeah, it was on top of a yurt.
Yeah.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
And largely, Three Ricks and some of the other people at HBL and Rotha, she built these yurts from her own design. So,
a yurt being a Mongolian tent or something equivalent that is used over there. They're very big and very comfortable. Well, they can be anyway.
I didn't know where they got were struck with the idea, but I think this is something that they had in hand, and it worked out really, really well. I've never built a yurt before, and I assembled a couple of them.
Well, you do well in Mongolia then, because they're constantly on the move with those things. It's a nomadic society in many parts, and they literally move from one part of the country to the other with their yurts, and they rebuild them in the places that they go. So you had a little taste of that. They don't point lasers up in the sky. Maybe that's a tradition you can get started over there as well. But you were on a Native American area of land, and I understand that they were rather impressed by the blue laser, which suddenly was showing up everywhere.
Like local fire and EMT from the tribal emergency services organizations that are part of the tribe and the reservation there, and they were kind of mingling around and keeping an eye on things during the event. And we had sort of built up a rapport and wanted them to know what was going on. And they were very, very interested in what we were putting together and watching it and had a really good time. So I also talked to some people that were helping with vending, like local people that had come in to sell like different kinds of snacks, I think, basically. I didn't really go over there. I brought in a little bit of my own food. But... yeah, they really thought it was a cool installation among the many other projects that were there at tour camp. And HBL did a really good job. And they're looking for a little bit of help donation-wise. So you can check out the final blog post, I think, is up at hackerbotlabs.com. So,
okay,
yeah,
great.
Yeah, local people were really kind and enjoyed it.
Uh-huh. Well, I
have a lot of good things to say.
I'm sorry I missed this one, but hopefully there'll be another tour camp at some point out there, because it seems like some kind of tradition is being started.
They've promised to do one in 2 years.
In 2 years?
In 2 years.
Why in 2 years? It's right after Hope.
And, well, because they don't want to conflict with the European
camps.
But we are
camps. So... Yeah, but you know how hard it is to...
There's only so many years in a you know, series of years.
Well, we should figure something. Maybe in the middle of winter or something. How about that?
I'm not going camping in the middle of winter.
Okay, I'll go.
All right, have fun.
All right, any final words on tour camp? And hopefully we'll be reporting other hacker events in the near future.
Everyone should have gone. That's
well,
my advice.
It would have been overcrowded if everybody went.
You should have gone if you're listening to this and you didn't go.
Kyle, any final words from you?
Oh, I had a really good time. I love the location. I wonder what they'll come up with next, if they'll use a similar spot. It's a beautiful area out there, the lowlands and the... a beach forest, and that interface is really spooky. It was very magical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of mist and condensation in the air, so the battle yurt made everything sort of glow and illuminated everything. But the beach had all sorts of its own magic, like bioluminescent creatures and all that kind of fun stuff. So I just liked being out in nature, and it was really a terrific, terrific event, and real intimate, and exciting. People should check these things out. It's a fun way to get together with other hackers.
Cool. And hopefully there'll be more such events, and people will be inspired to hold their own in the countries that they're listening from as well, because there are so many more than there were just a few years ago. Is that true, Kyle, about Microsoft bracelets, though? They were giving those out?
Yeah, the bracelets are like the silicone, rubber band style bracelet.
Uh-huh.
And I guess it's black, and they had it embossed with white ink, and on one side it says TourCamp, one side it says Microsoft. And so I guess they got sponsorship money in various ways, which they're pretty open about from the get-go on their website.
It's just I'm seeing Mike here wearing a Microsoft logo,
yes.
And in order to get him to do that, I just, you know, it's amazing that they pulled that off.
Yeah,
that's
on the inside of the band, by the way, it says 1GYLSFM. FUEHLTHDE.
I'm not going to try to pronounce that.
Puzzles.
Yeah, there was a crypto challenge that I don't know if anyone solved, but there were clues all over the event, and that was one of them that I just said.
Uh huh.
I'm not going to repeat it.
No, don't do that. Anything else, Kyle?
Oh no. I'll catch up with you guys again later. I'm still unpacking and sort of reassessing what's next.
Okay.
So long, everyone.
Well, I'm sure it'll be exciting, whatever that is, and thanks for joining us. Next, I assume this person in the studio I don't recognize is our guest for today. Is that correct?
So I've been told.
All right. This is Aaron Schwartz, who's giving a talk tomorrow called How We Stopped SOPA. Is that true, Aaron, if that is in fact your name?
It is true, and that is my name.
Good. Okay. I'm glad I guessed that right. So now this talk is taking place. I just see an address here. What's the name of the place it's taking place at? It's at 99 Madison Avenue, is that correct?
Yep, and people can go to illegalinstruction.com to RSVP.
Okay, how did we stop SOPA, and have we in fact stopped SOPA, and what was your role in stopping SOPA?
Well, you should go tomorrow and find out is the real answer, but it's a fascinating story. It's one of the few examples, not just in hacker culture, but in political culture generally, of people coming together on the internet and actually stopping a major bipartisan initiative.
Actually, you know, it'd probably be best if for our listeners we explain what SOPA was, because some people might not know what we're talking about. Anybody want to take that on?
I think Aaron's qualified.
Okay, go ahead.
So this was a bill. It ended up becoming known as the Internet Censorship Bill. It had a whole bunch of different names as it went through the congressional process that would allow the government to force every DNS server in the country to block certain websites. So
the effect would have been that I can't get to websites the people don't want me to get to.
Yeah. If you went to Canada, you could get to the website. If you went to Mexico, you could get to the website. The website would still exist. The servers would all be there. But if you tried to visit them in the U.S., you would get a blocked message, or it wasn't totally clear what would happen, but you would not be able to get to it.
It doesn't seem very practical for me to go to Canada every time I want to visit a website.
Well, you would think, you know, part of the internet is that it's international. You don't have to go to certain countries to visit certain websites, but I guess the U.S. government wasn't so happy about that.
So now this actually was on the verge of passing. It was almost a foregone conclusion as late as last year, or late last year. And then something changed. What was that happened?
Yeah, it totally turned around. I mean, that's part of what makes the story so amazing, is that Hollywood spent hundreds of millions of dollars a year lobbying for this. It was their major legislative initiative. They went to the White House. They went to members of the Senate. They said, look, we're a huge donor to all of you. There's one thing we want, and it's this bill. You have to get us this bill. This is, you know, it's all we ask for. If it doesn't happen, we'll go crazy. And so they made it a huge bipartisan initiative. It was about to sail through the Senate. It was going to sail through the House. It was this close to passing. And then what happened was the internet community rose up and stopped it.
Now, was it individuals on the internet, or was it some conscientious leaders of big corporations or big organizations that made it a bit louder?
Well, so that's the interesting bit of the story. So Hollywood wants to tell you this story that, oh, what happened was it was just Google and Yahoo, and they all got together and they used their big megaphones and their popular websites, and they just lied to the American people and misled them about what happened. And so, you know, it's not an inspirational story at all. It's just a story of big companies lying. Now, that is not the case, as I'll explain in my talk. But when the bill first was going to be introduced, when it was first about to sail through the Senate, I remember going to the Hill, and Google was there, and Yahoo was there, and all the major companies were there. And their perspective was, look, there's nothing we can do to stop this bill. Maybe we can make it a little bit better around the edges. Maybe we can carve out some exemptions for us about it. Maybe, you know, we can get some nice things thrown in addition to the bad stuff. But they did not think they could stop this bill. And in fact, I spent, you know, over a year trying to persuade them that they could stop this bill, that they should do stuff to stop this bill. And what eventually changed their mind was not, you know, a couple executives of big companies, but that people on the internet who came to my group, demandprogress.org, and signed our petition and pushed groups like Wikipedia, open collaborative communities, to take action about this, that then eventually forced the company's hand.
Interesting. So that was really the turning point when it showed up on Wikipedia on the front page, and various other organizations started raising the volume a bit. Take it from there. What happened? People just started, there was an internet blackout day. There were all kinds of, all of a sudden, stories in the media about this.
Yeah, so I think, you know, to start the story a little bit earlier, the bill was originally going to sail through, and I found out about it on a Saturday. My friend Peter from the EFF called me. It had been introduced the day before or something, and it already had enough co-sponsors to pass through the entire Senate. It was introduced with 60 co-sponsors. They had taken the bill and walked around the Senate to all the senators and gotten them to sign their name onto it before they'd even shown it to the public. And so on the day the bill became public, it was already clear it was going to pass, probably pass unanimously. And they had scheduled it for a vote in just a couple days without any hearings or any debate or any discussion because it was seen as so uncontroversial. So when I heard about this bill, you know, the first thing I thought was, this is crazy. There's no way Congress could actually pass something this ridiculous. But then I went and read it, and it turned out it was all true. It was exactly as Peter said. It was going to censor the internet. And we put together an online petition, and Boing Boing and other sites got the word out, and hundreds of thousands of people signed and called their representatives and got the vote delayed. And then there was this long period of trying to persuade other people to get involved, where the continual response was, that's so crazy, that can't possibly be true. You know, there's no way anything like this could pass. And the moment that I think first changed the tide was when they held the first hearings about it in the House, and you had members of Congress saying, well, look, I don't understand how the internet works, but it's full of criminals, and we got to shut it down. And, you know, we would show these video clips to people, and they were just shocked. And that's what began getting people on board, and that's what led to the big blackout day.
It's funny, everyone in Congress talks like that. That was the guy from Connecticut, I think. Yeah, it's crazy. But okay, at that point, people actually started to realize, wow, we have a chance of turning some heads on this and making a change. What was the defining point for you where you realized, wow, we're going to win?
It wasn't the blackout day. It was actually in the weeks leading up to the blackout day. And what happened was it went from being this thing where I and a couple friends said, you know, we got to do everything about this. We've got to throw our all into stopping it. We've got to recruit as many people as we can, to pretty much the entire technical community believing that. I mean, if you were on Reddit or Hacker News, or, you know, I held a big meeting in New York of all the local startups, and all these startup founders were saying, what can we do to stop this? And it was no longer, you know, a bunch of activists trying to stop it. It was now the entire technical community saw that responsibility. And very quickly then, even before the blackout day, you saw things began to shift. The Republicans began backing down, the Democrats began backing down. And then on that day of the blackout, when Wikipedia went dark and put up a message saying, call your representative, and Craigslist went dark and put up a message saying, call your representative, and even Google had a little tiny notice at the bottom of the page, then it was just overwhelming, you know. Every hour there was a press release from another member of Congress or another senator saying, like, yes, I know I co-sponsored the bill and voted for it three times, but I never read it. Now I realize it's terrible. And I'm totally against it and was always against it.
How do people say that with a straight face, that they never read something they signed? They're in government.
Isn't that a requirement for being in Congress, that you can say things like that with a straight face?
One that they admit to. I mean, wow, that's a real wake-up call. Kind of like the maybe the DMCA, one of those pieces of bad legislation that passed without people reading it, or even the Patriot Act. People didn't read that either, did they?
They didn't have time.
No, they passed it almost immediately. So SOPA is dead. Can we say that SOPA is dead?
Yeah, amazingly. I think it's true.
But you know there's going to be another SOPA. There's going to be something else that they try. How are they going to, you know, try and get past these people?
Yeah, they've tried to bring it back in a couple of ways. And so far, I think what's happened is there's been a sea change in awareness. It's not like it used to be where people thought, oh, you know, we'll just be on the internet and government can't stop us because we'll use encryption, right? Now people realize this stuff matters and they're paying attention. And so we saw a couple months ago there was this cybersecurity bill where they thought, oh, there's all these cyber criminals, so we need cybersecurity to cyber stop them or something. And
they've already tried this, though, because now SOPA hasn't been dead that long, only a few months, but they've already tried to resurrect it.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. They gave a big speech upon introduction of this bill. So, you know, I want to be very clear, you know, because they do talk like that. I want to be very clear. This bill is not SOPA. It's not anything like SOPA. It doesn't have copyright in it anywhere. You should not be worried about this bill. Go worry about the other bills. And, you know, they thought, oh, if we just tell them it's not SOPA, they'll suddenly stop paying attention. But in fact, it didn't work, and people paid attention, and we managed to get that bill killed too.
Uh-huh. But they're not going to stop. They're going to keep trying, and eventually they're going to figure out some method of getting around people's backs or maybe hiding it in something else. Are we prepared for those kind of tactics?
Well, I think the question is not, you know, can we keep stopping it? Can we keep stopping it? But is there something positive we can do to move the ball forward? So we get some stuff that we want. We get maybe DMCA reform, or we get compulsory licensing or something that will actually solve these problems instead of, you know, Hollywood's attempts to continue to criminalize people, to continue to increase punishments and not actually accomplish anything positive.
Yeah, I think another effect of all of this, another really good effect and a great precedent that's been set is since it was basically the users of the internet that killed SOPA, and we've all we all have experienced this now and have seen it happen and have gone from a mindset where, okay, this stuff is all in the hands of these people who don't understand anything and there's nothing that can be done about it, to, hey, we beat this thing once, and when the next bad thing comes around, we can beat that too. So it's really sort of an empowering feeling to have seen this all happen and think, okay, well, next time maybe it won't be so terrible, because maybe we'll be able to rally our troops and do what's right again.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most amazing thing, is that people pulled this off. You know, I talked to staffers in Congress and even members of Congress and senators, and when you bring up SOPA, their eyes go wide, and they're like, I've never seen anything like it. It totally terrified them. They were completely scared. We had a real impact in a way that I think nobody thought was possible. You know, even Chris Dodd, a former senator and head of the plan to pass SOPA, the guy who dreamed the whole thing up.
He's the head of the MPAA,
right? He's now the head of the MPAA and their chief lobbyist, and invented the bill and tried to get it passed. You know, basically my chief nemesis. Even he said he'd never seen anything like this in his 50 years, you know, watching politics. He was completely blown away by it.
Well,
it's amazing.
He'll probably see it again, so in case he missed any of it. Now, tell us, Aaron, your involvement. How did you get to be so much in the front lines on this?
You know, I think it was interesting timing and a little bit of luck. So I had been in the technical community for a while. I worked on a specification called RSS and started a company called Reddit. And then I decided...
Well, you started Reddit.
Okay. I was one of the co-founders.
That's pretty good.
So I was in the technical community. I sold the company. I made a bunch of money. And I figured, you know, there's got to be something I can do to accomplish more good than just starting another startup and selling it for some money. And that got me into the world of politics. Larry Lessig was also doing more political work, and so I started hanging out with him, and I started learning how these things worked. And it was basically in a period where I was trying to figure out what to do next, how to start something, when I got this phone call saying, there's this crazy bill, and we have no idea how to stop it, from some friends at the EFF. And I thought, well, let's try this stuff out. I think I know how this works. Maybe we can do something.
There have been so many crazy bills, though, over the years, various child protection acts on the internet and things like that. That was the first phone call you got?
Well, I think something is different now. I think part of it is social networking, but there's just so many more people online, right? It used to be, like, remember the Communications Decency Act? Mm-hmm. You would go on IRC and you'd tell 100 friends and they would all black out their website. But now when you have something like Wikipedia that has a totally global reach that everybody depends on every day, when you have, you know, sad to say, but sites like Facebook with hundreds of millions of people on them, mm-hmm. there are alternative outlets for getting this information that just weren't there before. You know, if you had to do this a decade ago, it would have been impossible because the television networks refused to cover it, and there just weren't these mechanisms for telling the story.
How do you get the attention, though, of people on Facebook? Something has to go viral. How do you get the attention of people at Wikipedia so that they take up the cause?
Yeah, that was the hard part, and that's, you know, what I've spent the time practicing and hopefully have figured out a bit about. But it's about figuring out how to frame the issue in an interesting way. You know, the traditional way lobbyists frame this issue is in a very wonky way. You know, if you had talked about this as being a bill about DNS filtering for copyright policy, I don't think anyone would have paid attention. And, you know, I think what was the interesting contribution was figuring out how to frame it as they want to censor the internet. The government wants to take control of your internet connection and make it something visceral that everyone could understand and identify with.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead, Bernie.
Aaron, I wanted to ask you, this is Bernie down in Philadelphia. Obviously, this was a sort of a landmark thing to happen and unprecedented. I would imagine that the folks at the MPAA and the folks in Washington have put a lot of, gone back to the drawing board, not just for this particular bill, but to try to prevent being blindsided again by this sort of grassroots internet lobbying that happened to shut down SOPA. So I think they're going to be more prepared for this sort of thing next time, so they won't be like totally blindsided and say, oh, we never saw anything like this before. Do you think it's possible that what can people do? Our listeners, all of us in the internet community, what can we do to keep this momentum going and improve upon the results that this yielded, so that we can sort of stay one step ahead of the folks that would just sort of roll over us with bad law?
Yeah, I think that's the right attitude. So my group, demandprogress.org, is trying to do that. We're trying to take, you know, we have 1 million people who took action on SOPA there's other groups that are we're working with that have another couple million, and we're trying to say, okay, what can we do next? So there's been a little bits and pieces about an Internet Bill of Rights and certain positive legislation. But the real question is, what can we come together around the Internet that will move the ball forward? Obviously, it's very easy to all say we want to stop this bad thing. But the thing we have to discuss is, what can we all support that would be positive? And how can we keep moving the momentum in our direction rather than let them regroup and take it back?
I also think something that was key in the success of this was that how basically every corner of the Internet got hold of it. It wasn't just the tech geeks who knew the ins and outs of it, but like when your average Internet user couldn't get to Wikipedia, they saw a page explaining it in simple terms that they could understand. And like you had people, creative people, creating things, great songs and stuff about it, and things to explain it to the masses. And you had like, I was on one image board where they explained it in cat macros. So like just all these different ways of expressing it to get hold of people who wouldn't normally be listening to issues like this.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite moments was the day of the blackout, I was sitting next to this cute girl on the train, and we got to talking, and she heard I was in technology, and she said, oh, you know, you really need to stop soap.
Yeah, we had some fun with that, soap being soap in Spanish. Right?
Soup.
Is it soup?
Yeah.
Soup.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Oh, I got to fix something then.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so this was a pretty black and white issue, though. You know, good versus bad, very easy to explain to people. How do you explain it, though, to people who aren't on the Internet, like, you know, your grandparents, people like that? How do you do that? Was that even attempted?
Yeah, well, I think what's interesting is raising the First Amendment aspects of it. You know, there's a battle going on right now to define all these civil liberties that we take for granted in the offline world about freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom from unreasonable warrants and, you know, wiretapping. Mm-hmm. All of that, you know, people understand that. They understand that they have these rights. But when they get translated to the Internet and you put the word cyber in front of it, suddenly it all becomes magical. And, you know, is it a question, do people have cyber speech too? Do they need cyber warrants, right? And so I think making that as clear as possible, making them understand there's nothing special about it being on a computer. It's the same old stuff they've always dealt with. That's the key.
And talking of the offline world, I don't know if you were paying attention to possibly the mainstream coverage, like on TV news and stuff that was coming about, because there didn't seem to be much of any
until
0 Hour. And like there were things like there was one screen grab of something off of, I think, Tech TV, where they showed somebody waving a sign around that said "Go SOPA," which it turned out had been photoshopped from somebody holding up a sign that said quite the opposite. And so they seem to be like a huge mass of not getting it, whereas on the Internet, everyone knew the deal.
Yeah, well, I spoke to someone who worked at MSNBC at the time, and they were told from the highest levels of NBC that you can't talk about this. We're lobbying for the bill. You know, you can't oppose the bill on this network. And so that was intentional.
Could they report on it, though?
They were told to just avoid the whole subject. There was one MSNBC show that reported on it, and they invited the general counsel of MSNBC to come on and explain why it was a good thing.
Uh-huh. And MSNBC is known as the liberal network, as opposed to Fox. It just makes you realize where things actually stand in the media world.
Well, so I don't think this is a liberal versus conservative
issue. No, it's
not.
It's my point.
Some of the very first senators to come out against this bill were Republicans, particularly, I think, because Hollywood has given historically so much money to both parties, but more money to the Democratic Party, and, you know, they'll do what they say.
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the interesting things, is how on these issues, the right and the left come together. And what you see is it's not a debate between right and left, but it's a debate between the sort of mushy centrist establishment and mm-hmm. people with real political views. Right now, actually, we're working on a campaign at demandprogress.org to get both the Democratic and Republican parties to put Internet freedom in their party platform. So at the convention, both candidates will have to endorse it.
Interesting. Well, now, obviously, this is just one bill in just one country. There are things going on all over the world. Do the same tactics apply in different in Europe, for instance, where they have was it PIPA in Europe they had?
ACTA.
ACTA, right. There's so many of them. That's the other thing. You get lost in all the different things that are happening. If you go to the EFF webpage, where just so many things to oppose and to be concerned about, where do you start? But if you add in other countries now, how do you possibly keep track of it all? How do you network everybody together?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we have to do, and that's why I'm giving this talk, is we have to look back and see how we did it, right? We have to see what the lessons were so that we can repeat them. But the other part is that we have to build an identity. And we saw a little bit about this, and that's kind of why ACTA was stopped. But we have to build this notion that, oh, the Internet is out there, and they're going to come and get you. And once that threat is there, you don't have to do it every single day. People don't have to call in every single day. it just has to be known that if you do try and pass this stuff, we'll come and get you. And that's what Hollywood has done so well. They know if they ever try and loosen copyright or they ever try and do something Hollywood is upset with, they will come down with all their force and fury on members of Congress. Now members of Congress have gotten a taste of that from the internet as well, and we need to make sure the whole world knows it.
Interesting. Now, your talk is actually in exactly 24 hours from 7 to 9 o'clock tomorrow night at 99 Madison Avenue. Aaron Schwartz will be talking about how we stopped SOPA and presumably how we'll be stopping the next thing that comes along, which whatever that might be. Aaron, do you ever have a problem, though, where not everyone agrees, where it's not such a black and white issue, where some people say, you know, I see the point. We do need this. We need to infringe on our right. Because we get this in the real world all the time. People say, well, the First Amendment is, you know, only up to a point, and then we have to start cutting back on some rights for the nation's security. Have you met with any resistance like that?
Well, I mean, certainly in Congress, there was lots of resistance.
I mean, on the internet. I mean, with people that, you know, you're trying to convince.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, we got lots of, especially at the beginning, we got lots of angry letters saying like, oh, you know, they need to do some stuff. Why are you against everything? You know, isn't there anything you're for? And
wow. Okay.
You know, I mean, yeah, there's always going to be dissenting people. But I think what we showed with this was that the majority was so overwhelmingly opposed to this bill that, you know, even if there were a couple people on the fringe, they were a shockingly small minority. I mean, Hollywood tried very hard. They spent an enormous amount of money on ads to try and get anybody to call in favor of the bill. I mean, we got emails. They were literally begging directors of movies to please call into Congress because nobody was calling into Congress to mm-hmm. support the bill. But they just had a really hard time because once people understood what the bill was about, I mean, so many people were against it.
But they didn't have to make those phone calls to start with. The bill was on its way to being passed just because they said so, right? It was that much power they had.
Yeah, and, you know, because they invested a lot of money in it. I mean, mm-hmm. they constantly are holding Hollywood fundraisers for every member of Congress, every senator. And so, you know, when Hollywood comes up, calls you up and says, we want this bill, you listen to them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. We're talking with Aaron Schwartz, giving a talk tomorrow night at 99 Madison Avenue, 7 to 9 p.m. Are tickets required or anything like that?
People should RSVP at illegalinstruction.com.
Okay. RSVP at is the email address. RSVP.
No, just go to illegalinstruction.com and there's a web form you can fill out, and it's got all the directions and information.
Okay. Do people have to show picture ID? And
No picture ID.
Good. Okay.
Not like this place.
Not like this building.
We're not locked down.
We're going to take phone calls, 212-209-2900, if you have any questions for our guest or any other comments on other things going on in the hacker world, in the technological world, in the world in general. But please, a couple of notes in advance. Speak when you're spoken to. In other words, when we say you're on the air, that's when you begin speaking, and turn down your radio and try to talk about something that has to do with something we're talking about.
Do you think this is going to work?
I never really tried it before, but it just seems like whenever we take phone calls that we get a lot of confusion sometimes. So I'm hoping that doesn't happen. 212-209-2900. Let's see if it happens. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook. See, this is what I'm talking about, the silence.
Yeah.
You know, all you got to do is talk. I'm going to move on to the next person. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Please speak now.
Hi.
Hi.
Rose.
How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Having a little difficulty hearing you.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to shout.
Okay, that's fine.
Might be the
All
phone.
Right, just quickly, how did Senator Ryan vote on this bill?
Oh,
is he interested?
I can guess how he would have voted, but Aaron, you want to take that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, Congressman Ryan, like most of the Republican Party, was originally in favor of the bill. I mean, eventually, I think it got squashed before he had to vote on it. Because it was killed in the Senate, and then he was in the House at the time and didn't have to vote on it, but he was definitely one of the proponents.
Okay, great. I thought he might have been a senator at the time. Okay, great. Have a great evening. Love your show.
Thanks for calling. 212-209-2900. We have a full switchboard here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
This is Chris.
Hi.
And I guess you hear me?
We hear you fine.
Okay, very good. I've been trying to use your website, demandprogress.org, to do some of these programs. It's telling me that I have to put in my country, even though I put in my zip code. So there's a little glitch there. I'm using Mozilla to try to use the system.
Well, put in United States, I think it will solve that, right? Just put in the country.
What's that? No, but it wants a zip code if you're in the United States. But when you click submit, it says you've got to put in the country, and there's no box to put in the country. If you click I'm not in the U.S., then it gives you the option of putting in the country, and you can put in the U.S., but then it doesn't. I'm sure it's going to send you to the wrong box because it wants to direct you to your own congressman.
This is how we lose these battles, because of things like this.
I'm sure that Aaron will fix this.
Are you aware of it? Yeah, you're already texting somebody to get on it. All right.
Yeah, I'll text them.
Thanks for the trouble report there. Anything else, though, you wanted to say?
Well, yeah, there's a site called downsizedc.org, which has some related things. One is hands off the internet. They have a web form where once you filled it in for one of their campaigns, you filled it in for all the campaigns, and you can send anything out. Well, I'm not sure your system does that, but it makes it very convenient because you don't have to keep filling in the same boxes again, which makes it much more convenient than using your idiot Senator Schumer's web form, which requires, 50 different spaces to be filled in. Some of their programs are the Read the Bills Act, which would require Congress to spend some time reading the bill before they vote for it. So you'd have 2 or 3 weeks to generate opposition to a bill. Because all this stuff is going to be coming back and probably hidden in a big budget bill. Remember, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades was 3,000 pages long, stuck in the things like you have to get your infant child a Social Security number that was hidden in there somewhere. All this bad stuff. The other campaign that downsizedc.org has is one issue at a time. Pass a bill that would require every bill to only deal with one issue.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense, and these are good ideas. Do you agree, Aaron, that these are good?
I mean, I think some of them go a bit too far. Like, certainly it's good to have time to read the bills, and it's good to not be sneaking things through. I think sometimes people, they get upset that members of Congress haven't literally read every page of a bill, and I think it's fair that you don't read every page of a 3,000-page bill and instead depend on experts to look at it. The problem wasn't that they didn't read it, because they wouldn't have understood it. They don't know what DNS servers are. The problem is they didn't bring in any experts. They were literally shocked when we suggested bring some computer people to the hearing so that it can explain to you what you're doing.
Well, I consider having an expert read the bill and tell you what it means similar, at least, to reading it, but not having anybody reading it is really problematic.
Someone should be reading these
Someone
bills.
Should, not just passing it on demand. Let's try and take some more phone calls. We have a really, really full switchboard here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, great show, guys. I miss the hacker conference. Is a lot of that on? I have two questions. Is a lot of that on like archival? Can you see Mr. Rambam's lecture?
Well, you can hear all his talks. If you go to hope.net, you'll see links to all the audio. And we have low res video of at least the first three conferences up on our website as well. If you go to store.2600.com, you'll be able to find it there for Hope, Beyond Hope, and H2K. And we're going to get all of them up there at some point.
Okay. Do you also have Steve Rambam's number, or how do you spell his name to get in contact with him?
Well, his name is spelled Rambam, and I believe the website is pallorium.com, pallorium.com. Thanks for that call. Let's move on and take another one. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up, please.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Okay, we don't have time. We only have a few minutes. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up, please.
Hello?
Hi.
Hold on, let me just take a drag.
Okay, that counts as not having your radio turned down either. Good evening, you're on Off the Hook. Speak up.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Quickly now, quickly.
Yeah, let me turn this radio down.
All right, I don't know what it is. You're not getting the memo, folks. Good evening, you're on Off the Hook.
Good evening. I would like to call England. I have a friend there. I'd like to call him more often than I do. Are there any inexpensive phone cards that I could purchase to make this possible?
Yes.
Don't be a wise guy, Mike. Tell him some more information than that. I mean,
go to the deli and say, I want to buy a phone card to call England. You'll probably pay three cents a minute.
Point. Is there one or two or three that are better than the rest?
I don't have a complete database in my head, but you can probably find under a nickel a minute if you try a little bit.
Best way to find out is to ask somebody who has a friend in England who goes around and tries different ones what his opinion is, and that's you. So we expect to hear back from you and tell us which one is the best one for talking to your friend in England. Thanks so much for your call. Rob?
Also, if you go to a deli and they sell different phone cards, they should have charts of what it costs to call each place with them. So, you know, you can look at them and compare and get the nicest one.
You could also go on the internet and ask around there. I'm sure people have all kinds of opinions. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Okay, that's too long. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Too long. What is going on here? It's like a plot of some sort. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Please speak.
Hi, I'm sorry. Can you just spell Mr. Rambam's name one more time, please?
No, I can't. I'm sorry. Listen to the archive. Boy, people are trying my patience today after driving 4 hours in the rain. No, I just can't handle this. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. It's the Annoy Emanuel show, apparently. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Okay, I think there ought to be a constitutional amendment to limit any proposed law to 1,000 words to make sure that these guys actually read it in Congress.
Okay, what do you guys think about that?
I mean, I agree with what Aaron just said a few moments ago, that it's not necessarily about the congressman reading every single word of every single bill, but that someone should read it. And, you know, the Congress people don't have time to read every bill. They've got more important things to do, like fundraise, and that's okay. But someone somewhere should be reading the bills and telling the Congress people what they say.
I think we should restructure the whole system where it's not all about fundraising anyway. I think airways should be free for political stuff so that people can actually see what anyone has to say, not just the people who raise the most money. And maybe less time will be focused on raising money constantly and more time on doing their jobs.
I agree with that, and so do a lot of Congress people, but how we get from here to there is not clear.
Well, we got to change some rules and...
Yeah, I mean, the airwaves one is nice because the FCC can do it unilaterally, mm-hmm. right? You know, and Obama has appointed a majority of the FCC. So if he wanted to, he could tell them just to say, look, make the airwaves free for political
speech.
Yeah, well,
every political ad was free from this point on.
You know, I mean, the main thing they raise money for is millions of dollars in TV ads. Mm-hmm. If you just told the TV companies to host the ads without charging them money, they would not need to raise anywhere near as much.
Right, and the TV stations are doing just great with all their commercials and paid programming at night. And things like that. Let's take some more phone calls in the brief time we have left. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
I am an enchanter.
Okay, that's wonderful. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Too long. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up.
Yes, I'm not particularly internet savvy, but does a proxy server allow you to get around any block sites?
Good question.
Yeah, I mean, if you use something like Tor, and you know, you go to torproject.org and download Tor, you would have been able to get around the block, but... You know, it would have been annoying to tell everyone in America mm-hmm. to download this software. I mean, maybe we could have done it, but it's still frightening to imagine that you have to route your traffic through another country just to visit websites. It's
Plus,
crazy.
Don't only criminals use that kind of thing, you know? It's just for the child pornographers and the drug dealers and things like that. That's what people think. They really believe that. And obviously, you know, we have to educate them on that front as well.
There's also only so many countries, and only so many of those countries have fast internet. And if you have to route all your traffic through, say, Iceland... it's going to be a problem.
It'd be great for Iceland, though.
Yeah, well,
we need to talk more about Iceland in the future, that's for sure. Rob.
The point is, you can use something like Tor, but you shouldn't have to. It's like asking you, if you want to go to the library, you can't go in the front door because it's nailed shut. You have to sneak in the back window, basically.
They did that to my library, but they're doing a lot of bad things. Aaron, I want to thank you for stopping in today and wish you the best on your talk tomorrow. Hopefully, we can make it there as well. Again, it's at 99 Madison Avenue. Is that a particular type of building? It was just a storefront. 99
yeah,
Madison Avenue? Okay.
It just says 99 on the front.
All right. Well, that sounds intriguing. Tomorrow night, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And the website again to register?
Illegalinstruction.com.
Okay. And it's totally legal to go there.
It's totally legal now.
I wonder if that site would have been blocked by
Please go to it before they do block it.
All right, folks. Sorry for being short on the phone, but no, I'm not really. Write to us, oth@2600.com. Stay dry. See you next week. Good night. You're ready.
WBAI is een niet-commerciële zender, gesponsord
Ciao,
door luisteraars.
Ciao, sono Letizia, e quando sono a New York, ascolto WBAI su 99.5 FM.
Nitwa Jacqueline Murekatete, ndi umurescapi wa genocide y'Abatutsi yabaye muri 1994 mu Rwanda. Murimo kumva.
Kukatu sam v New York, a zvijengi slušam WBAI 96.
Mi nombre ta Elsa, anto sam permitim mi radio sintonisa na 99.5 FM WBAI.
What language do you speak when you call back home and talk to your grandmother or cousins? Join WBAI's ongoing community outreach and produce a station ID for us in your native tongue. You can contact the program coordinator, Michael G. Haskins, at wbaiannouncements@gmail.com. Let's celebrate each other.
And you're tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org on the web. The preceding program, Off the Hook, was brought to you live with certain portions on recording. And we hear next the Personal Computer Show.
And good evening, this is Joe King. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. With me here in the studio is Hank Key on this Wednesday, August 15th in the year of 2012. On the West Coast, we have the dulcet tones of David Perry, our security whiz. Good evening, David.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Hank. I'm actually in a recording studio this evening. I'm in the home recording studio of recording artist Lawrence Juber. Used to be the lead guitarist in Wing.
I still laugh when I come across a cartoon that was a young, very young person looking at Sir Paul McCartney saying, "Daddy told me you used to be in something before Wings."
Yeah, I've heard that joke before.
Oh, okay. Our special guest tonight will be joining us in just a moment. Is somebody that you all have met here on the mics of the Personal Computer Show at least once a year for the last, not decade, but much of it. the head of Technology Education Support, a well-known company. He's a technical and security architect, a systems developer of quite some note, Mr. Constantine Kanaklides. Good evening, Constantine.
Good evening, Joe.
And Hank, it's your show.
Okay. Constantine, we're going to get right down to the heart of what everyone wants to know is, what is one, you know, people hear Windows 8 and Windows RT. What's the difference and how do you differentiate? What is it?
Hank, I think you should have done something before that question.
Okay, go ahead.
Tonight we're going to be talking about Microsoft's new operating system, Windows 8, which is just coming out. I think part of it was released today, was it not, Constantine?
Correct.
And I think folks have a lot of questions about it, so ask your first question.
Which is, by you also hear Windows RT. What's the difference?
All right, well, Windows 8 is the generic term for the operating system implemented on x86, typical x64 architectures, etc. Windows RT is solely for ARM-based machines. And ARM is a specific firmware that basically aims at the market of lower-end devices and especially far more than 80-90% of their business in the world of tablets and tablet computing. So the version of Windows 8 that goes specifically on ARM, that's Windows RT, the RT standing for real time.
Right. So, ARM is a processor, not firmware.
Right. It's really an architecture, and there's a whole number of companies that have licenses with ARM, like Qualcomm and NVIDIA and
NVIDIA
so on.
Right? So,
yeah. Motorola and so
yeah.
on.
Now, with Windows 8, when you talk about Windows 8, is it just Windows, or is it more than just an upscale Windows 7 to Windows 8?
It's a lot more, and that is, as they say, they've re-imaged it. And the idea is that they basically built it for the touch generation, the world of touch devices, both single-touch and multi-touch devices, as well as for traditional upgrades using a desktop. And it has dual interface, right? The interface is, on the one hand, what is now known as the modern interface. Microsoft still uses the term Windows 8 UI, but the official term has been modern, replacing the older term Metro. And that interface is all oriented towards touch generation. Tiles on the desktop, rectangular tiles, borderless windows, low aspect of Chrome, no menus, no explicit close buttons, etc.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt for a second because some terminology gets confusing. Mm-hmm. You say a low incidence of Chrome. You're not referring to Google's Chrome.
No, correct. I should have said that. That's right. Low Chrome means all of the gloss that you would typically see through toolbars, through buttons, and through other sidebars and other devices. So the idea is to use the screen 100% and avoid any degradation of the experience that focuses on content, on what the content is.
Are you trying to tell me there won't be an Aero look?
That's correct.
Oh, shucks.
That's correct.
I just got used to it.
Goodbye, Aero.
Well, how many versions of Windows 8 will there be? I assume it's going to be more than one version.
Right. They've charted out a strategy, a four-way strategy. You mentioned the RT, Windows RT for ARM processors. So that's one. And that will be split into what they call the Surface line. Surface meaning a single look and feel across all of their Windows product line. And there'll be a Surface for Windows RT, which is the ARM, but there will also be a Surface for Windows 8 Pro. That will run on Intel, AMD, etc. And that also is an addition that is made for laptops. Now, other than that, there is Windows 8, the base. It has no name. It's not called Base Edition and so on. Microsoft just refers to it as Windows 8, which is the lowest end edition.
Would you say that's the equivalent of Windows 7 Home?
That is exactly right. That's the mapping people should think of, the Home Edition. Now, Windows 8 then goes to Pro, which targets more features and a higher path where people typically that they're thinking about vis-a-vis Windows 8 Pro are people who might now be on Windows 7 Professional or Windows 7 Ultimate. That's the audience. Now,
let me just ask a quick question. If I'm interested in Windows 8, I have to buy a new machine?
No. No, you can upgrade. Like any operating system, you can upgrade your existing system.
Oh, now wait a minute. You say upgrade. Now, if I have an XP, I can upgrade that?
You can always upgrade any Windows system to another.
Okay. Yeah. Can I upgrade That's XP correct. Directly to Windows 8 or it's yeah. only for...
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
the answer is yes.
Let me ask Hank's question a little bit differently. Will any machine that currently runs Windows XP, any edition of Windows XP, without any hardware change, would you be able to run Windows 8 on it?
Well, that's a different question. Windows yes. XP is upgradable to either version of Windows 8 or Windows 8 Pro. It's upgradable.
From a marketing point of view,
right. it's upgradable. And so... And Vista and so on. Well, I mean, from my point of view, I own a netbook, Toshiba netbook. I upgraded it to Windows 8. It was XP.
It does need to be said that if you upgrade your existing computer to Windows 8, that does not automatically make it into a touchscreen computer.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you know, hardware doesn't materialize because you do an operating system upgrade. So no question about that. And the type of upgrade matters critically. In other words, there's what's called carryover. Carryover is what we all want in an upgrade. It says, carry everything I have in my existing machine over. That means settings. That means all of my data. But most critically, means all of my applications,
you mean,
too.
You mean my applications on XP will run under Windows?
No. I said... In other words, what matters is the type of upgrade. So there is a carryover upgrade for Windows 7 and for nothing else.
Oh, Windows 7, I now have a laptop with Windows 7. I can be sure that if I upgrade to Windows 8, all of my programs on that Windows 7 machine will continue to run and the data will be readable.
All the data, all of the settings will be carried over. The applications will be upgraded. Whether they are compatible with Windows 8, you have to check with the Windows 8 Compatibility Center.
So nothing is automatically conceived.
Right. Now, if I looked at, so I'm a developer, so I had on my XP application, I had over 120 applications, including developer editions, Office 2003, Ancient History. I had, you know, every single possible firewall, et cetera, because I isolate them and I do testing. They all carried over. In other words, from my XP, I carried over everything. I'm running Windows 8. I even carried over Windows Live Mail, which I happen to be using. And so that was fine. There's no guarantee that every single application will upgrade, but Microsoft tells you which ones will, which ones won't, and what you can do about it.
So I can take an XP machine and basically do a carryover, although individual applications may or may not work.
Well, no. On the XP machine, all right, when you're dealing with an upgrade now, not standalone. When you're dealing with an upgrade, the only carryover that is called true carryover, which means the applications also, that's from Windows 7, right? So when I said that my applications run under Windows 8, and they were formerly applications on Windows XP, I install those applications. In other words, I took the CD of my Office 2003 and I installed it under the new Windows 8, which I got by upgrade.
I see. So it wasn't upgraded automatically.
Applications will not upgrade from XP or Vista.
What about a
Oh, Or Vista?
Or Vista.
Okay. Now, what about a third party like PC Mover, which when I got Vista, I used PC Mover to move all my applications over?
Right. Now, that's a great question and near to my heart. I swear by these people. Right now, it'll cost about $59 when it comes out after the 26th. But right now, you can have, it's called PC Mover Windows 8 Beta Assistant. It's a work of art, and it's free. It's going to be the full edition that Laplink will be selling after October 26th. But you can have it now free, and that's what it does. It basically migrates all settings, all applications, including, say, your inboxes, your deleted and trash mail, and so on, anything you want to preserve over to the Windows 8 environment. That's free. So definitely get it.
It's a late beta. It's not early, but because it's a beta, it might have some anomalies in it.
I haven't seen that it's a beta.